the only one who thinks a night with someone means a hookup. I have a boyfriend. I'm the only one up for bid that's committed to another person. Guilt already gnaws at my insides. But with Ernest as CEO, my family's wealth inside the philanthropy is at risk. I'm caught in a moral web between family and love, and I'm wondering how those two missed an intersection and when they started running in opposite directions. What are you thinking? Pharaoh whispers while the auctioneer repeats a few technical details about bidding. I stare far away in thought. I think this is the part where I'm supposed to choose between my company and the guy I love. I look right at him. Real or rumor? SFO say that a lot, especially when we were on tour. Real or rumor? His eyes caress mine. Rumor. This auction is a pseudo-fake thing, Wolf Scout. And what you and I have is real. Whoever bids on you isn't a threat to me. His brows arch. Bluntly, you're not cheating on me by going up there, and you can't walk away from this. It'll kill you not to try. Yeah, but what if trying kills me too?
Maximoff, hail!
The auctioneer with slicked hair and spectacles calls me up to the podium, and 2,000 eyes fix on me.
3. Pharaoh Keen. As I retrace my path up the aisle, headed towards Omega, Maximoff climbs the few stairs to the stage. Stoic, unbending, and undeniably striking, he stands beside the podium like a 15th century sculpture, body and jaw carved from marble. And the affluent crowd is about to bid on the modern, real-life version of Michelangelo's David. He's mine. I don't love him because he's a coveted piece of art to the thousands here and the millions outside. I love him because he's so pure it hurts, so moral it aches, and so strong-willed it kills me not to speak to him, not to be near him, not to look at him, or to protect him. Velveteen seats squeak, bodies shifting to open purses and reach in pockets for a remote device called a clicker. The audience is electronic. No hand raising or numbers hoisted. My boots feel heavier. Each step is cumbersome and barbed as I put more distance between me and the stage. Instinct says, turn around, don't leave him, don't leave him. I fight the urge to rotate, race toward the stage, climb up and kiss the fuck out of Maximoff. My jaw ticks, and I stuff my hands in the pockets of my slacks. I'm not losing him. I'm not really leaving him. What I said was true. This isn't real, but shit. The desertion is a kind of torment I've never experienced. It bites at my heels as I walk away and let him do this alone. Since I'm not his personal bodyguard at this event, I can't be a part of the night portion of a night with a celebrity. The night is planned 1 week from now, at a location Ernest hasn't disclosed yet, and I have to trust Bruno to protect Maximoff there. Unless I can win him myself. I pull a clicker out of my pocket. I already registered my information in my bank account, and this is my attempt to prevent bad shit from happening. I reach SFO, and no one seems surprised that I went rogue and chose my boyfriend over door duty. It's not just me being a maverick. If that had been their own client, they'd be hard-pressed to say they wouldn't do the same. Akara spins his phone in his hand. He'd be tenser if Sully, his client, were participating in the auction. I can't vouch for you anymore with Alpha, he tells me. It's not sticking, and we're in a spot where Omega has less leeway. I nod. Okay. I can't say I'll change my actions, but I'd rather Akara not put his neck on the line for me. I can take all the heat. Oscar motions me forward, about the same time I slip between Donnelly and him. I face the stage, and my stomach overturns. Maximoff is staring off in the distance, lost in his head, almost like he's not here. I'm not close enough to wake him up. The grandson of two Fortune 500 moguls with the billion-dollar companies Fizzle and Hale Co. The auctioneer pushes up his silver-rimmed glasses and reads a bio to the audience. I partially tune him out and whisper to Oscar, "How much do you think he'll go for?" "More than you have, Redford." I roll my eyes, but I would have said the same thing. This is a fucking pipe dream, but Luna only went for 12 grand. Jane was 40. Oscar bats his eyelashes. It's the thought that counts. Did you come up with that one all on your own, Oliveira? My curt voice draws his lips down. This shit is actually serious to me, and he notices. How much do you have to spend? Oscar asks, his strict tone matching mine. 12 grand. Donnelly smacks a pack of cigarettes on his palm, but he won't smoke in this venue. You really sold it? I had to. With all the fines I incurred on tour for breaking security rules, my bank account sat idle at $300. I don't need to be an Ivy League grad to know Maximoff's price tag will be much higher than that. Sold what? Quinn Oliveira asks. The youngest bodyguard sidles over to us, distancing himself from Thatcher Moretti, the 6'7" immobile bodyguard who hasn't budged verbally or physically since we've been here. A silent Thatcher is my favorite Thatcher, because when he's speaking 9 times out of 10, it's to reprimand me. Since he accepted his demotion, no longer a lead of any force, he scolds me 8 times out of 10 now. But he has no real power over me anymore. Farrell sold his bike, Donnelly answers, sliding an unlit cigarette behind his ear. Quinn gestures to me.
Bro, I would have bought it. I've been looking for one.
I keep watch of the stage, Maximoff, the auctioneer, and Omega all at once. What would you have offered for a 5-year-old FZ09? It's a Yamaha, Oscar says to his little brother.
I know.
Quinn snaps and rubs his unshaven jaw, frustrated. Oscar raises his hands. Just trying to help. Quinn ignores him and nods to me.
4 grand.
And that's why I didn't sell it to you, I say easily. And then I catch some of the auctioneer's words. At 19, Maximoff Hale attended Harvard University and swam for their team. I heat, the clicker damp in my palm. I rub my hand on my shirt, then I glance at Oscar, feeling his gaze on me. He's perceptive and clever, a lethal combination for those who don't want to be analyzed. But I don't mind. You can say it, I tell him. He puts a hand on my shoulder. I've never seen you like this. I've never cared about someone like this.
What'd you sell it for then?
Quinn asks me about my bike. 12 grand, I say distantly, hearing voices escalate in the lobby behind the double doors. Quinn frowns.
No way it's worth that much.
It's not, I say. The guy was an idiot. Truthfully, I put the ad on Craigslist and mentioned how the motorcycle belonged to Maximoff Hale's boyfriend, and a middle-aged man bit the bait. He said he had no plans to ride it, and after he made an offhanded joke about a CVS deal on lotion, I wasn't going to ask.
Oscar watches the stage, then me. Should have just sold the boyfriend's motorcycle. He's more popular than you.
Oscar knows that fame is why I got more for less. I'm not selling my boyfriend's Kawasaki to win him, I say. Also, his bike is a piece of shit. The brand is great, but he's had his Z1000 since he was 16 and crashed multiple times, as aggressive on a bike as he is in a car. I tried riding the motorcycle, and it had almost no torque. Oscar opens a snack-sized bag of Lay's.
Fans don't care if his bike is a piece of shit or a plastic vehicle in Barbie's dream house.
Donnelly digs in the chips. You know a Kara's bike would have sold for more. Oscar slaps Donnelly's hand away.
This is snack-sized, for one person. Me, get your own.
Donnelly gives him a middle finger. Akara hears his name, vaguely listening to our conversation. I'm never selling my bike, guys. He has a CBR1000RR sport bike that he wrecked, but he cashed in a favor with Banks, the most skilled mechanic on the team. Thatcher's twin brother worked on the Honda, removed the fairings, fixed the engine, and turned the bike into a street fighter. It's beautiful, and worth more than what Akara paid for it. At 21, Maximoff Hale was honored with the World's Philanthropy of the Year Award for founding one of the most profitable charities. The noise behind the door grows louder, footsteps pounding, and we all shift before the door creaks open and a head pops out. I see a tight bun, Botoxed forehead, and an ankle-length dress. No, I don't recognize this woman, but her beady gray eyes land on me.
Mr. Keene,
she whispers.
Come here, please.
She gestures toward the lobby. I'm not leaving. What is it? I ask. She glances nervously at the few heads we turn from the audience. Whispering, she says,
I've been informed that you are no longer serving as security tonight. I can't let you in the orchestra hall without paying the entrance fee. I'm sorry.
I run my hand over my strong jaw. Someone on the security team had to have informed the event staff. My narrowed eyes drift to Thatcher, but he's still staring unflinchingly ahead. Focus. I act quickly and whisper to the woman, I can pay afterwards.
You can't. I'm sorry. If you'd step into the lobby, we can get your entrance fee squared away and you'll be able to return.
I may not make the start of the bidding, and I make a split-second decision. I raise the clicker between Donnelly and Oscar. Which one of you fuckers wants it? I'm trusting them to bid for me if I'm not back in time. Oscar licks his salty thumb from his chips. Can't choose between us, Redford? I'd like to make that choice, but I met them both nearly at the same time in my life. I was just 18, and 10 years later, we're all still here. I can't say who needs each other more or less. We've all just been there in rough terrain, and that's why I can't choose right away. Oscar sees and takes the clicker. Donnelly isn't good with numbers. Go. On my way out, I warn, you bet over 10 grand, Oliveira, and you'll be paying for my bar tabs for the next decade. Oscar crumples the chip back. Love you too, bro. I slip through the doorway, and the auctioneer's voice fades. With the heavy door open for a half a second, Thatcher turns to peek into the lobby. He's clearly looking for his client, and I don't let him see Jane. I kick the door closed, his glare meeting mine before it shuts.
This way.
The woman directs me past a fancy concession bar that sells wine, caramel popcorn, and cocktails. I follow and survey my surroundings. The carpeted lobby is quiet, even as a throng of security hovers near Luna Hale and Beckett Cobalt. Maximoff's little sister sits on the staircase that leads to the balcony levels, and she's showing Beckett something on her phone. Could be a fanfic story that she wrote. She looks better than earlier, more talkative. Near the restrooms, the woman stops at the registration table, laptops opened and papers stacked in neat piles.
Pharaoh?
Jane exits the girl's bathroom, a blue tulle skirt over leggings and cat-eye sunglasses perched on frizzy brown hair.
Isn't Mafia on stage? He needs one of us out there in support.
I'm dealing with some shit. I gesture to the table, and the woman stiffens at my language. Sorry. I apologize to her and open my wallet. You can go, Cobalt. Jane frowns. You're right, I tell her. He needs you. I want his best friend to be in sight if I can't be, but it's not easy to swallow the fact that money is what's obstructing me. Jane studies the table, the woman, my wallet, putting two and two together. Especially as the woman tells me,
we don't take cards for the entry fee, only check.
Shit. My fingers freeze on my wallet. Who carries around a checkbook? I ask, my gaze drifting as soon as Jane unzips her yellow sequined banana-shaped purse. I blink once, and Jane already has the checkbook open, bending over the table to write the amount.
2,000, correct?
She asks me. I appreciate the gesture, but I prefer buying my own way. Jane.
You'll pay me back.
Her blue eyes flit up to me as she scrawls her name.
You don't have time to argue, and if you have another plan, please let me know.
I don't. Okay. I nod. I'm not sure if she's doing this more for Maximoff or for me. I almost roll my eyes. Of course, this is for Maximoff, but I'm lucky that he has Jane unflinchingly on his side. Thanks, Cobalt, I say as she rips the pink check out of the book. Jane offers a small smile and then passes the check to the woman. I don't waste another second that Jane's given me, and she's right in tow as I re-enter the orchestra hall. Thatcher reaches a hand above Jane's head behind me, just to hold the door open for her, but she follows my lengthy stride, catching up quickly. The auctioneer is already spewing numbers at rapid speed.
2K, would I get a 3K, 3K, would I get a 4K? Somebody bid now, make it 5K.
I can spend 12 grand again since I didn't need to use two. When I near Oscar, he clicks the clicker, but the device lights up red. Meaning he was too slow and someone else, whose device lit up green, locked in for that bid.
Boyfriend is popular, Oscar says and passes the clicker to me. I only got the 1K bid, which is null and void now that it's at,
We all listen to the numbers. 7K. I click at 8K.
flashes red.
Merde,
Jane mutters. Fuck, there are too many bidders. Somebody bid now, make it 9K. Finally, the device lights green. 9K, would I get 10K? We got 11K. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I click and click. Red, red, we got 12K. Green, I hold my breath, and we all wait to see if a rich prick bids on him. Somebody bid, make it 13K. The auctioneer chants. Don't, I want him. 13K, he shouts and bangs a hand on the podium. He pushes up his slipping glasses. Would I get a 14K? My stomach drops. I can't let this eat at me. I saw this happening from the start, but an acidic taste runs in the back of my throat. Jane has her knuckles to her lips, worried. That's not good. I look down at her and ask, what's the chance that one of your family friends bids on him like they bid on you? Jane has already gone through this process tonight. After Maximoff is finished, Beckett and Charlie are the only two left. 14K. I hear the number grow.
Terribly small,
she whispers. And me and the rest of SFO listen closely as she explains what most never hear.
The old woman who bought the night with me? She was the friend of my socialite grandmother, and my grandmother has never doted over Moffy the way she does me. She buys me $1,000 teapots when she knows that I dislike tea, and she only gives Moffy store-bought cards with no signature.
I catch myself grinding my teeth. Donnelly tightens his loose cartilage earring. Grandma Calloway sounds like a bit. His voice trails at Akara and Thatcher's reprimanding looks. Itch, bitch. I meant bitch. 15K. Paul, Thatcher snaps. Donnelly lets it go without care. I'm stuck watching Maximoff stare off in space. Green lights flashing in the hands of the audience and my muscles tighten. That acidic taste in my throat keeps rising. Jane shifts her weight, nervous. 17K. Redford, Oscar says my middle name with a flat tone. It's serious, and I instantly follow his vigilant gaze to a boxed seat up in the third tier across the orchestra hall, where Charlie Cobalt sits. His bow tie is undone, white button-down sticking out from his slacks, sandy brown hair ruffled. Oscar has been keeping an eye on his client, and something's not right. Charlie is bent forward, hands on the railing, unblinking, watching, too carefully. He's usually slouching or slumping in disinterest, but Charlie zeroes in on the audience while clickers blink green and red, too interested in this outcome. All of a sudden, Charlie bolts to his feet and disappears through the upper tier door. Oscar whispers, he knows something, and he's not gonna tell his shit. I say softly. This is Charlie. He'll tell his older sister. Oscar's dark curls fall over his forehead as he nods towards Jane. Jane looks uncertain. I tilt my head.
You're his sister. He can be abnormally private,
she says, as though being left out doesn't hurt.
We should find Beckett, though Beckett will only spill Charlie's secrets if it's life-threatening.
I don't pretend to understand the Cobalt family hierarchy of secret-keeping and secret-spilling. None, if it has any ounce of order or sense to me. Boss, I'll get my client, Donnelly says about Beckett. He already pushes the doors to the lobby before Akara says, I'll go with you. They leave. 25K. Oscar brushes his earpiece. Someone's speaking. And I never thought I'd miss my radio or Alpha in my fucking ear. While I wait for him to fill me in, I concentrate on Maximoff. He stares at the wall, his trance broken, but he's listening carefully to the number. 28K. Oscar touches my shoulder. Charlie is coming here to speak to you. It can't be good. No shit. My voice dies as the double doors blow open. The pop of noise causes a wave of mutterings and heads to turn. Charlie couldn't care less, his attention plastered to me. What is it? I ask. That acid in my throat is bile. I taste it. My gut, my intuition that I rely on, sickens with dread. He nears quickly, his shoulder brushing mine at the same height, and he says, hushed but fast, you have to win him. I shelter the urge to ask why. I don't have 30 grand. I'll wire you the money. Charlie cuts me off, not removing his intense yellow-green eyes from my face. Pharaoh! Urgency is on my name, but I can't tell if fear, worry, or something else accompanies it. He reaches for the clicker in my hand. I pull back, and not wasting time, I press the button.
The device blinks green and I enter the 30K bid. Someone else bids 31K, but I manage to get to 32K before anyone else can.
Charlie,
Jane whispers.
The HMC board said we're not allowed to pool our money into any bids. It was a stipulation. Fuck the board,
Charlie says beneath his breath, and to me he says, continue. I comb a hand through my hair. If this is serious, Charlie, security has the ability to shut down the entire auction. Maximoff wouldn't want to end an event early, Charlie cuts me off. A short laugh sticks to my throat. When have you ever cared what Maximoff wants? 37K. It's fine, Charlie says, glare on my glare. It's fine. You're going to win him. The solution is right here. I should grab Maximoff off the stage. I should leave with him, but I can't tell if that instinct is just me being hypervigilant of the guy I love, combined with the after effects of a stalker. I'd like to say that Nate, that sick motherfucker, didn't affect me, but I'm standing here questioning my natural instincts. My memory makes years feel like yesterday's and weeks feel like minutes ago. Great for sex, better for love, shit for what Maximoff calls doomsdays. I can still feel the animal blood pouring down my head. I can feel Nate's limbs slipping out of my grip and how my adrenaline thrashed my pulse. I almost shut my eyes, but the image would still be there. And I have to live with this forever. But I wish it didn't have to fuck with my reflexes. Normally I wouldn't hesitate this long. Fuck it. I make an abrupt choice and put trust in Charlie. I stay here to bid on Maximoff. There's no going back. Who else is bidding on your cousin? Oscar asks Charlie. Charlie is quiet. He had the best vantage point in the box seat, and he could tell whose clicker kept lighting green. I stare at backs of chairs and heads, unable to distinguish the person I'm electronically contending.
Charlie,
Jane snaps angrily and speaks in rapid French. He replies back just as swiftly in the same language. The auctioneer spouts off.
45K, got 46K?
My clicker lights green, locking in the bid, but the auctioneer's voice suddenly fades, and the orchestra hall goes strangely quiet. The auctioneer frowns and lifts a tablet he's been using.
It looks like a bidder has put in a high offer.
Oh no,
Jane breathes. I run my tongue over my lip piercing, watching concern pass through Charlie's features. He brushes a hand through his disheveled hair. It's fine, but I can't tell if he really means it. I grit down. Fuck this. I look at Oscar. I'm getting him. I'm getting my boyfriend off the motherfucking stage. Oscar nods.
Wait a second,
Charlie says with more confidence, holding out a hand. The auctioneer sets down the tablet.
We'll start the auction at the highest offer.
He clears his throat.
2 million, would I get a 2.1 mil?
No chance. I don't even know if Charlie has access to that amount of money, and he could lie and say he does. I pocket the device, and Charlie stares ahead, not stopping me.
Going once? The auctioneer calls.
My stomach somersaults. Charlie, who's bidding on him? I ask.
Going twice.
Charlie's eyes are locked on the stage like he's in a daze.
No one good.
Sold.
Violins screech as the quartet plays again, calling for an intermission, and hundreds rise, congesting the stage and aisles.
Get him.
I head down the right aisle, and I'm surprised when Charlie Cobalt follows me step for step.
4. Maximoff Hale. When I was 17, I told my dad, I don't think I'll ever fall in love. I couldn't imagine a person fitting into my unconventional life. I couldn't imagine a companion at my side. Not like that. In my head, there'd be no one for me. No man, no woman, no person. I'd be alone. And it was supposed to be okay. It'd be okay that it would always be just me. Only me. My dad, with amber eyes that could cut the soul into jagged pieces, stared right into me. Where most would fear him, I bathed in warmth. Those sharp-edged eyes, with their bitter history and raw truths, comforted me. And he said, "Before I had you and your siblings, your mom was the one good thing in my life. And I know I'm supposed to tell you how love conquers all. How we could move mountains together.
but the love we had almost destroyed us both. Love is like having a mortal wound, and you're bleeding out, and no matter how hard you look, you can never find the goddamn cut. He never broke eye contact. I kept looking, listening, feeling his words. It's its own special brand of pain, he told me, because no matter how much you love, you're still a passenger to their life. You have to watch all their bad decisions. You can't think for them or change them. Just be there for them. And sometimes, it's not going to be good enough. Sometimes things happen out of your control. He paused. Love is pain. And you know what? I feel sorry for anyone who hasn't met it yet. I think about that. As my boots cement and the stage lights overpower my vision, rows and rows of blurred faces staring back, I think about love. How I thought I'd never feel it. The pain. The kind my dad scorned, but also ached for. I don't want Pharaoh to be a passenger to my bad choices, watching my fucked up decision to be sold for a night. But I keep picturing Pharaoh Redford Keene. I keep imagining him running down the aisle, coming towards me. Because if our positions were reversed, I'd want to pull him off this damn stage. And I'd know I can't. He can't. I'd feel like screaming and screaming and screaming just to reach him, until my veins burst in my neck and my lungs set on fire, until my last breath was used to call his name. I imagine him, climbing on stage in one swift motion, his intense focus meeting my tough gaze, his hand catching my hand, his inked arms sweeping around my shoulders, pulled together, not letting go, never letting go. But I don't see him, or even hear him. He's just the agonized love inside my head.
Sold! The auctioneer yells.
I blink out of my thoughts and near the stage stairs. A delicate hand touches my shoulder, and I swing my head, meeting the kind eyes of a 20-something girl. Probably an event coordinator. Probably. Christ. My face twists in a bitter expression that I almost never fucking wear. Because I'm not even a tiny bit sure who she is, or her job description, or why she's on stage. I've been told next to nothing. At this event, I'm just a celebrity guest. The one up for bid. At the events I organize, I know everything, down to the names and faces of the cleanup crew. Ernest didn't think I'd cooperate if I had knowledge, so he's blindfolded me. Worse, I have no idea where the auction money is going. The board muttered something about humanitarian projects, which is vague and nondescript. And the company should be clear and upfront with all the guests tonight. So I'm not thrilled about the money raised at the auction. Being reinstated as CEO of HMC Philanthropies is the only good thing that'll come out of this. Sorry, I apologize to the girl before I ask. Who are you? I have to shout as the classical music blasts next to me, a violin in my ear.
An event coordinator!
She flashes a Night with a Celebrity event badge with her name, Tammy.
We're taking a 15-minute intermission.
Who's up next? Beckett or Charlie? She shrugs and forces a smile as an answer. Great. I descend the few stairs. Guests mingle in the aisles and around the stage. Bruno grants me about 15 feet of space, enough that I forget he's even there. I'm closer to the right aisle, and that's when I see him. Pharaoh slips through the chatty masses with a determined stride. His shoulder bumps into a woman, and champagne almost spills on her emerald necklace. Wait, why is Charlie behind him? I move faster, squeezing past guests, as Pharaoh weaves between other bodies. Both of us in pursuit of the other.
Maximoff!
A few people call for me, wanting to talk. I don't stop. Not until no one and nothing barricades Pharaoh from me and me from Pharaoh. His arm instantly curves around my shoulders, and with his other tattooed hand, he holds my jaw, his lips against my ear as he whispers quickly,
Charlie knows who won the $2 million bid on you.
My heartbeat pounds against Pharaoh's hard chest. $2 million. I nod stiffly. I had no idea I was one for 2 million. I must have tuned out that part, and I can't conjure the kind of person who'd spend that life-changing amount on me. We both turn towards my cousin who nears. Charlie plucks a champagne flute off a server's tray and downs the drink in 2 gulps. He sets the glass on an armrest of an empty seat. Not giving a fuck. Typical. But his indifference doesn't grate on me right now, because I'm majorly confused. Who won me? I ask Charlie, and I keep my arm around Pharaoh's waist while his arm hangs over my shoulder. Charlie steps closer so we're in a huddle, no one overhearing, and he loosens his already loose bow tie. Ace Steel. My brows knit. Who? I look to Pharaoh. He stares hard at Charlie.
Never heard of him.
Charlie runs his hand through his hair and pulls at the strands. Not anxiously. He does it when he's bored, too, and it always makes his hair stick up in odd places. And Jesus, I don't know why I'm fixating on this. Yeah, I do. Because I've been sold for $2 million. Because Ernest has invaded my wheelhouse, steering my ship towards someone with maybe, possibly, fucked up intentions. Charlie takes a pair of black sunglasses out of his pocket, prolonging the answer, and he slips them on. It's nighttime. We're indoors. Cameras aren't even flashing at us. There's no sense in most of what he does. And sometimes I think that's why he does it. I let out an agitated breath. Charlie,
Ace Steel is a porn star.
What the fuck? My brows scrunch more. You're fucking with us, I state. Charlie shakes his head once.
Not this time. And I know what pornography companies do to our families, so I warned your boyfriend. He failed at winning you, and that's not on me.
Pharaoh rolls his eyes, but I'm superglued to the fact that Pharaoh tried to win me and rescue me off that stage. I'd say I don't need rescuing, but I'd be willing to let Pharaoh rescue me. I just wouldn't outright tell him that. My chest rises in a deeper breath. I have no idea how he would have paid for me, but I guess it doesn't matter since he lost me. Metaphorically. And a porn star literally won me. Awesome. You sure it's a porn star? I ask Charlie. He gives me a look like I'm being senseless.
Of course I know. You can Google him if you don't believe me.
I get why I don't recognize the name Ace Steel. I don't watch porn, but Pharaoh does. Or did. Or maybe he still does. Stop thinking.
Straight porn, Pharaoh says matter-of-factly.
That's why the name didn't ring a bell for him. Pharaoh only watches gay porn. A straight porn actor just purchased me. I tilt my head backwards and stare upwards. Dear world, is this a joke? Sincerely, a wide-eyed, severely bewildered human. I crack my stiff neck. Let me conceptualize this, I say to Charlie in motion to my head. Ace Steel is a guy who only does straight porn with girls. Charlie overturns his champagne flute, the lip of the glass to the armrest.
Correct.
This makes no sense. Pharaoh is eyeing the center section of seats. I can't tell what he thinks or how he feels about this. I rake a hand through my thick hair. Why would he want to buy me? Charlie arches a mocking brow.
He could want to do a scene with you.
Huh? What? I have no clue what scene means in this context. Pharaoh peels his gaze off the audience, just a glance at me, the corners of his mouth rising. My neck almost heats. His amused expression practically broadcasts that I'm now 6 years younger, 6 years less experienced, and he's older, wiser. Stronger. I am younger, but he's definitely not that much wiser. At least not in everything. Pharaoh lifts his hand to hold the back of my head as he says,
A scene is just the term used for pornography shoots. Actors are paid per scene filmed, etc. And there could be multiple actors in one scene, He barely pauses before asking Charlie, "Is that him?" Pharaoh points someone out in the center section, on the row nearest us. "That's him," Charlie confirms. I don't stare long, my focus on Pharaoh. I'm not interested in whatever this porn star has to offer. So if that's why he bought me, he can save his money. My tone is firm, like this could be just an ordinary business deal. You know, normal. Weirdly, it kind of is. Porn producers used to call me all the time, especially when I hit 18. And I get it. I'm the son of a sex addict. People are curious, and curiosity sells as much as sex. But I always had zero desire to upload me fucking anyone for you to see. Now that I have a boyfriend, my desire has plummeted to negative infinity, and my stomach is in fucking knots. Pharaoh rubs a thumb against the back of my neck. Loud and clear, he tells me. We'll let him know. He gestures for Ace Steele to come over, and the man who stands up looks like a Spartan warrior with gunmetal eyes, a quarterback build, and stubble along a hard jaw. He's older than me, probably around Pharaoh's age, and he wears a tux like he has millions of dollars to spare. My phone starts ringing. Pharaoh looks at me, and I dig my hand in the pocket of my green jeans. I clutch my phone and check the caller ID. Winona Meadows, Sully's little sister. It's Winona, I tell Pharaoh, since Charlie has disappeared into an empty row ahead, slouching on top of a seat, sunglasses still on. It's family. I don't want to ignore her. But there's a porn star currently squeezing his way out of a row to meet me, and I don't want to leave him with Pharaoh. My boyfriend sees my confliction and says, "Go." He nods towards the door. "I can deal with this guy." I hesitate. "Maximov," he urges. "Go." Pharaoh sends me a single look that says, "I'll catch up with you later, Wolf Scout." "I'll be back," I tell him, and quickly put my phone to my ear. Walking up the aisle, I glance backward just to see Ace approach Pharaoh and extend a hand. Pharaoh doesn't shake it, and instead starts talking, lips moving rapidly but casually. Always at ease during tornadic activity. My lips lift, settled with this decision. But then Winona's voice fills my ear in a mad rush, and I stop in the middle of the aisle. My smile falls, and I start mentally gathering battalions.
"Mavi, it'll be past my curfew soon, so hey, let's skip the whole you shouldn't be here Nona bit and tackle the important parts," she says in one breath. Before I can reply, she's going on. "We need to talk to you. I think it might be bad. Really bad. You don't need to say anything yet. I'm about to text you all the details."
She hangs up. So you know Winona Briar Meadows is the 14-year-old fearless animal lover with a spirit as wild as the Meadows family. You follow her Instagram account that's littered with nature photography and rock climbing excursions. If she's not advocating for animal rights with Ben Cobalt, then she's hanging with her girl squad and keeping to herself. You beg her to post more selfies and you criticize her when she doesn't. I know her as Nona, my cousin who could practically be my little sister, who I used to carry on my shoulders through the Costa Rican forest while she snapped photos of every damn thing, the leaves, the dirt, the ants and the trees. She would bloody her hands, run off a cliff, and split open her heart for any living thing. And it's terrifying. Fair warning, I will decapitate you with a rusted blade if you fuck with this one. And she'll probably try to stop me. My head is spinning on Nona's words, "We shouldn't be here," and "bad," and the "we," and "we need to talk to you." Who's with her? Where are they? And what the fuck happened? Near the double door entrance, I spot Jane. She's stuck chatting with the old woman who bought her. I flag down Janie, and she pries herself away from our grandmother's friend. Strutting down the aisle, her banana purse thwacks her hip. I haven't talked to my best friend all night, and she's one of the people I'd want on my side during a shitstorm. I catch Jane's hand. "Bonsoir, ma moitié," I say, kissing her cheeks.
"It's just you and me, old chap," she replies. "And the older crew, security, and about 2,000 dreadfully stuffy socialites.
Cameras flash as we greet one another, and her blue eyes dart to the left, but not for long. She pushes her wavy hair off her shoulder.
Now that you're public with Pharaoh, one would think they'd care less about analyzing our friendship.
That's too predictable, huh? I guess our friendship is just that good. She smiles brightly, but her lips downturn as my phone vibrates in my fist.
I know that look. Who's in trouble?
Winona. We may need to leave early. I slip next to Jane so she can skim the text with me. The message has a ton of random nature and animal emojis. Ben drove us to the Philly Orchestra Hall. We ditched paparazzi, and we're parked in this dead-end alley thing on the side. We're waiting here for you. Please come to talk. It's very important. Winona.
Their personal bodyguards are here for the event, aren't they? I asked Jane.
She ties her hair back, cheeks flushed hot.
They were given temp bodyguards tonight. It's likely Ben and Nona ditched them, and it's even more possible they're here to protest the auction.
I don't know. I stare off, thinking. Winona and Ben are passionate about these things, but they'd both rush in and not just wait in Ben's car. It seems weird. I trail off and notice Charlie alone, still slumped on a seat. He tosses his bow tie to the floor. I've stopped bringing him into the fold, because he kept ignoring me every time I did. And maybe he still will. Maybe he'll hate that Winona called me first. But I don't want to chisel him out of my world anymore. I look to Jane. Should I ask your brother to come with me? Jane has always played neutral in my feud with Charlie, but I can tell it strained her relationship with him. She smiles.
Oui, oui.
Yes, yes.
Vous deux allez-y. Je vais rester avec Beckett, au cas où il serait bien tout appelé. Je ne veux pas qu'il soit seul.
You two go. I'm going to stay here with Beckett, in case he's called soon. I don't want him to be alone. I wave Charlie over, and he surprisingly drops to his feet and saunters to me. I explain what's happening and finish with, "Want to help?" Charlie stares at the ground, processing everything. And when his yellow-green eyes lift up to me, he answers, "You're in luck. I'm available." I was prepared for a fight, but this is better. So much better. And I turn on instinct, looking for someone else. Pharaoh. He's still chatting with Ace Steele down the aisle. But Akara and Oscar flank him, like they're 2 seconds from pulling him backwards. I cup my hands around my mouth.
Pharaoh!
I call out. And nearly every head swerves in my direction. Pharaoh locks eyes with me, and I know in this second that I want him with me. So I text Winona. Me, Charlie, and Pharaoh are coming in a sec. Don't drive away. She's fast to reply. Isn't Pharaoh like 6'5"? Ben's eco car is too small for all three of you. Winona. I type quickly as a 6'3" Pharaoh approaches, and I send, "Not if you sit in the middle seat in the back." K, hurry. Winona. I plan on it. 5. Maximoff Hale. Heavy rain beats the sleek blue electric car in a deserted alleyway. Car windows are fogged. An overhang on the side exit keeps us dry, and Pharaoh catches my arm before we run into the midnight storm with Charlie. My cousin already disappears into the front passenger side.
"Half of Omega is waiting in security's Range Rover in case Ben drives off,"
Pharaoh explains as he quickly fits in his earpiece and hooks a radio to his belt. "They really let you back on duty?" I ask. And we step into the rain together, our boots meeting the slick road. Pharaoh jogs around to the other door.
"I'm the best at what I do, Wolf Scout. Everyone needs me. Case in point."
He puts a hand on the car's wet roof. I clutch the door handle. He's right, but there's a difference between security and me.
"I don't just need you, though. I want you. I want you. God, I want you."
I express the carnal words in my eyes, and his chest elevates, seeing every loving want written on me.
Damn, he mutters, rain dripping down his temples and off his jaw. Damn. I inhale strongly. Yeah, that's about right. It's a good start to a doomsday, because I'm not always that smooth, and something needs to go right before everything goes fucking wrong. We both slip into the rear doors at nearly the same time, shutting out the rain. I brush water out of my soaked hair. Winona rotates to me in the middle seat, her face delicate and feminine compared to her older sister's strong, squared jaw. Her hair, lightened to dishwater blonde from the sun, falls on a man's button-down that's knotted at the waistband of her cargo pants. Her hazel-flecked eyes bore into me with so much emotion that it tries to knock me backwards. Are you okay? I ask.
No, I'm not okay,
she says powerfully, her eyes glassing and chin threatening to tremble. We're going to help, all right? I hug Nona, and she grips my shoulders. I rub her back, and I flip a figurative switch, trying not to feel the hurt that she feels. My eyes rise to Pharaoh. He studies my stone face, and he mouths, I'm here for you. I nod, I know, but I'm not sure how to be everything they need without shutting off emotion. What Pharaoh called a survival instinct. When my family breaks down, I fortify.
Nona, don't cry,
Ben says in a whisper, turning around from the driver's seat.
Because then I'll start crying again, and we're not going to move past the waterworks stage of this crisis.
You know Ben Pirip Cobalt as the 16-year-old savvy environmentalist who makes friends easier than all of my family combined. He'll even be your friend. He's probably already followed you back on Twitter or Instagram, and he's liked your pictures 10 or 20 times. You think he's one of the coolest Cobalt boys, with his accessibility, his windswept brown hair, baby blue eyes, and pretty boy charm. And you wouldn't be wrong. I know him as Ben, sometimes Pippi, the youngest and most free-spirited Cobalt boy, and my little cousin, a guy who wears his heart on his sleeve, who hurts over sad, broken things, and I know he wishes more people paid attention to important causes than the beauty mark on his cheek. Fair warning, I will hold you beneath a frozen lake and drown you if you fuck with him. You smell foul, Charlie says to his brother. Ben does stink, like locker room BO, but Winona has to be used to the stench. If it bothers Pharaoh, he doesn't let on. Ben scratches his hair. String-braided bracelets made by Winona fall down his wrist.
I'm doing a water-only wash period. I'm on week 4.
It's not working,
Charlie tells him and scoots his seat back on me.
Charlie,
I growl, the seat crushing my knees. Nona sits back up and rubs her cheek with the heel of her palm. She opens a box of salted crackers. Charlie is ignoring me, in case you were all wondering.
Are you cool?
Ben is asking Pharaoh, and at the same time, Winona crosses her legs on the seat, giving me room to shift mine in her space.
Thanks, I tell my cousin.
She offers me a cracker, and I pass since they taste like salted tree bark. And she offers Pharaoh one, which he accepts.
I won't narc, if that's what you're asking,
Pharaoh says and pops the cracker in his mouth. He chews slowly, his face scrunching, and I almost start laughing.
Cool,
Ben nods.
Pharaoh coughs in his fist, then unpockets a pack of gum.
Your cousin already likes me better than he likes you, Wolf Scout.
I give him a middle finger and his mouth curves upward. I tell Pharaoh, Ben likes everyone. It's not that big of an accomplishment. Ben flips on his windshield wipers.
I definitely do not like someone.
Who?
Pharaoh and I say while Charlie mutters.
This is new.
Ben checks his rearview mirror.
I also don't like idling in a dead end. You all mind if I drive out?
I think he's worried about being trapped in an alleyway if paparazzi find us. But like Pharaoh said, Omega is in a Range Rover nearby, probably watching for incoming vehicles. They'd alert Pharaoh before we get blocked in.
Vas-y,
Charlie says.
Go ahead.
Ben reverses his car. I extend my arm across the back of the back seat in a death clutch.
Jesus, I hate riding backseat. In any car, with any driver. I wish being a passenger on a tour bus could have cured me of this, but I'm just not that lucky. Pharaoh clicks his mic on his collar.
Omega to Pharaoh. We're heading out.
He rests his elbow near my hand, then lays his arm on top of mine, his thumb stroking my bicep. It takes me back to my car, that moment when we decided to be a couple, in a relationship, where we had our first kiss. I wonder if he's thinking about that too, or if I'm just sentimental because this is my first relationship, first love, and that was the most meaningful first kiss I've ever had in my life. Ben switches the automatic gear to drive once he reaches the main road, and then he aims for an on-ramp to the highway.
The Range Rover behind you is Omega, Pharaoh tells him.
Thanks, Ben says, and fixes his side mirrors with a button. Rain pours harder and pings on the roof. I really want to know why they're both upset. Who do you not like? I ask. Did they do something? Winona munches on a handful of crackers. I give her a look.
I'm a nervous eater, she mumbles,
crumbs everywhere.
And you're not going to like what we have to tell you.
Ben merges onto the highway.
It's your brother.
Xander.
What?
Charlie and I say in unison. My face contorts in confusion, and my pulse thumps in my ears.
I did something,
Ben mutters, guilt in his voice. My muscles bind. He's the kind of person who'd blame himself for accidentally stepping on an anthill, so it's hard to gauge the seriousness. Ben flicks his blinker but struggles to switch lanes and concentrate on this conversation. I look out the rear windshield.
You can go, Ben.
He tentatively scoots the car to the left lane and then accelerates to about 75, the traffic sparse at midnight. His finger keeps tapping the wheel.
I don't understand, I say to Ben. I know you and my brother had a falling out, but I thought you still liked him.
Something's changed, Ben replies.
But it's my fault. It's really all my fault.
I don't know what to take from that. Suddenly, Pharaoh drops his arm from me to press his earpiece, trying to listen. The rain slams down, and I check over my shoulder. A few incoming cars surround us when they have the whole highway. Pharaoh almost rolls his eyes before swiveling the knob on his radio. I whisper,
"What's happening?"
Three SUVs,
he whispers back, Winona between us who can probably hear.
Akara is yelling at Quinn to relax. He's getting amped.
Winona shakes cracker crumbs into her palm.
I still like Xander.
All right. Someone explain this, please, I say. Ben takes a tight breath.
You all remember how I used to bring Xander to the school's hockey games? Sometimes soccer?
That seems like forever ago. Ben Cobalt is a social butterfly, the exact opposite of my brother, but they somehow got along. To be in Xander's life, you have to wedge yourself in there, and Ben always snuck in, up until about a year ago. Their falling out happened.
You said you two grew apart, I remember.
It made sense. They were getting older, but Ben was one of the only people who could get Xander out of the house, and my brother has been more recluse since he lost Ben as a friend. But I never thought Ben actually disliked Xander. They just don't talk that much anymore.
That's not really why, Ben says. I mean, we did grow apart, but...
He tries to increase his windshield wiper speed.
I stopped bringing Xander to school events after something happened.
Something happened. And my brother didn't tell me. And I wasn't there for him. Guilt tries to roil inside me. Because if he was hurt, or in some kind of worse pain... Charlie hooks his sunglasses on his shirt.
That's not vague at all.
Ben side-eyes him before switching lanes to bypass an SUV.
Sorry, I'm not used to excessive adjectives and nouns to your liking.
He looks back at Pharaoh through the rearview mirror.
If you don't know by now, Charlie thinks I'm dangerously naive to the point of stupidity, and he wastes no opportunity to remind me.
Pharaoh pops another bubble in his mouth.
Cobalt or something else. Ben glances quickly at Charlie. Now that's vague. Charlie pulls at his hair.
I wouldn't expect anything more from someone who believes Maximoff is boyfriend material.
Ouch. Gotta give it to Charlie. He knows my insecurities.
Jealous that he's in a relationship?
Pharaoh asks easily, while lifting his boot to the seat and balancing his arm on his knee.
His confidence is radiating.
Charlie glares back at Pharaoh with a look that says, "You're wrong." Pharaoh combats him with a harder stare that says, "I'm right." I wish Janie were here to help us stay on track. What happened? I ask Ben and Winona. Did Xander get hurt?
Not exactly,
Winona says, brushing crumbs off her lap. I was friends with these guys at school, Ben clarifies as he accelerates.
Ben is friends with everyone,
Winona rephrases.
Yeah, but when I brought Xander along, I always introduced him to these people that I thought he'd like. Is that a pop?
On your right,
Pharaoh confirms as three SUVs line up to obstruct Ben from taking an exit. Speed up, I suggest, since that's the only way he can pass the cars and get off the highway. Ben scoots forward, his visibility terrible as rain pelts the windshield.
It's basically hailing. I can't speed up.
It's not hailing, Pharaoh says matter-of-factly. You're fine. Stay in this lane until you feel comfortable.
Pharaoh backseat driving is infuriatingly sexy. Anyway, we have no destination, but my phone keeps vibrating in my pocket. Uncle Reich and Aunt Daisy, Winona's parents, are concerned since she's passed her curfew. When it hits 1 o'clock a.m., I expect the same onslaught of messages from Uncle Connor and Aunt Rose about Ben. Once Ben leans back slightly, less edged, I ask, So Xander met some guys through you at these soccer and hockey games?
Yeah, Ben nods, and I thought it'd be good for him. I didn't think, I mean, I couldn't have known.
Winona drops her head, upset. Ben scratches at his hair.
People at school knew that Xander is on antidepressants. Rumors about that are all over the internet.
I tense.
Why is security's car changing lanes?
Ben asks, almost panicked.
Security is playing defense with the other vehicles, Pharaoh explains. SFO is stopping some cars from reaching yours. Don't worry about them. Oscar is a good driver.
Okay.
Ben adjusts his grip on the wheel.
At the games, students asked Xander if they could have some pills. And Xander actually started giving them his meds. And I should have looked out for your brother, Moffy. It's my fault.
Ben talks fast, the words rushing out of him all of a sudden.
He's susceptible to peer pressure, and he didn't ask for money or anything in return. He just wanted to be liked by these dudes.
My heart is in my throat. He was only 14. That's why you had a falling out, I realize.
Yeah.
Ben flicks his blinker but decides not to switch lanes. He tries to ease back.
I figured if I stopped inviting Xander out with me, he couldn't give anyone his pills. Since he's homeschooled, it made it easier.
He waffs his Save the Planet shirt from his chest.
After a while, we stopped talking and he just
retreated. My brother retreated and barely leaves the house. I rub my jaw, my muscles searing. Who knows about the pills? I ask and eye Pharaoh, who touches his earpiece. He checks over his shoulder, on the lookout for paparazzi traffic that steadily amasses. Ben lowers the volume of his stereo as Charlie turns the radio on.
Some kids at school, me, Xander, and Nona know, Ben says. And now you three.
Winona twists her otter pendant necklace.
Moffy,
she says to me.
We thought he stopped.
My stomach caves.
A kid in the neighborhood started texting me about it, Ben finishes. This morning.
He extends his arm backwards to pass me his phone, and the one gesture causes Charlie to stare out the window. He must feel like Ben just chose me over him. My ribs shrink my lungs. I could hand the phone back to Charlie, but with my little brother at the centerfold of this, I have an aching need to be in control. So I do the shitty thing and keep the phone. I already know Ben's passcode, the date his pet bird Pipsqueak died. And then I open the most recent message from the neighborhood kid. Pharaoh drops his foot to the floor. his nonchalance suddenly depletes. When that happens, I feel like someone needs to hoist the bat signal in the air.